This week on the BOAG World Show, we talk about persuasive design and the pros and cons of in-house development. This week's show is sponsored by FreshBooks and Full Story. Hello and welcome to BOAGworld.com, the podcast for all those involved in digital. What am I saying? That's not the right start anymore.
Oh, a bit of nostalgia, come on.
Oh, we got to keep it in, have we? Oh, let me try again. Hello and welcome to BOAG World Show, the podcast about all aspects of digital design, development and strategy. My name is Paul BOAG and joining me on this week's show is Marcus Lillington. Hello, Marcus.
Hello, Paul.
You're going to keep that in, aren't you, that introduction? I can tell.
I'm thinking about it.
Yeah, now I've made it complicated because I've now mentioned it.
So I kind of have to.
Oh, dear. Oh, well. I've kind of...
That's all right, because quite often I find that the music doesn't get quiet enough quickly enough and I have to boost that little bit. And if it's like meaningless nonsense, or even more so meaningless nonsense than it usually is, then that's great because I don't have to worry about it being loud enough.
Okay. So basically, I kind of follow that.
Welcome to my world.
Yeah, the things you have to worry about, Marcus. How do you make it through the day?
I don't know. I'm strong, you know.
How are you?
Big-hearted.
How are you? I don't feel like I've had a proper conversation. Should we just have a chat and forget the listener?
Absolutely. Well, I did very much after last week's last week's talk about writing nice emails. Your email that you wrote me was the best email. I thought, because it was beautifully put as well. It's like you'd spent some time thinking about, you know, the right words and all that kind of thing. And I thought, is Paul feeling all right? And then you finished it off with, is that better?
In its kind of passive-aggressive way, yes. So I've got to say, it has made a difference. I have been saying things like, I hope you're well, and other bullshit at the beginning of the email that I don't actually mean. You know.
Yeah, see, that's an interesting point to carry on the discussion from last week. I mean, should you bullshit? Because I don't know.
But
I
isn't essentially all social interaction just bullshit?
Not if you mean it.
Yeah, well, as I said, all social interaction, as far as I'm concerned, is bullshit. Because I'm a miserable, horrible person, basically. So,
well,
there you go.
Yeah, we've always said that you should be honest and, you know, kind of genuine.
So perhaps I need to start my emails with, I really don't care, but...
Yeah, well, just don't ever respond.
Yeah, just don't send email. There, sorted. Oh, my life is so busy at the moment, Marcus. So I'm...
Sorry, I need to pretend I care now, don't I?
Yeah. I'm
really, Paul, what are you doing to combat that?
I'm renovating my house. That's why life is so busy. Did you know that? I'm moving out and everything.
Why don't you just buy a new house, Paul?
Well, because there's nowhere that we really want.
Okay.
Because we kind of looked at this.
What with you being a multimillionaire, web celeb and everything.
Yeah. I mean, I should be living in a mansion. Where's my mansion?
Exactly.
It's not fair.
So what are you going to have done then? Sort of like, you know, like faux bricks on the outside.
Yeah. Pillars. Stuff like that. Pillars. We're going to get pillars.
Pillars.
And
perfect.
Lions. Stone lions.
I quite like stone lions for some reason. That appeals.
Yeah, but not on a 1970s end of terrace with white cladding.
It would work better than my little oldie worldie fally down cottage, wouldn't it?
No. I think lions should go on your place. You should have lions. You should have gargoyles. That's what you need. No,
gnomes. I have got some gnomes that were bought by my son and his girlfriend. I have gnomes in the garden that they bought.
There you go.
And I thought, well, actually, they're probably quite appropriate.
Yeah. I mean, I've been looking around at houses because we're going to spend quite a lot getting this place done up. And we thought, well, if we took that money and added it on top of our house, what could we buy? And you can't get anything. I mean, your house must be worth millions now, mustn't it?
Well, not even in where you live.
No!
I don't believe you.
It's true.
But no one has a job where you live or anything like that.
What do you mean?
I'm implying it's very backward, Paul.
That might be true. I can't argue.
Well, no, but seriously, if I wanted to live in Blandford, where you live, Paul, what are my job prospects like as a digital person? I'm not, you know what I'm trying to say. Somebody, I could be a project manager, say.
Absolutely, absolutely fine. You would go,
really?
You would work in Bournemouth. There is at least one large agency in Bournemouth.
So I have to, I've got one place I can work.
Yes.
Compared to London, where I've probably got 1,000.
Yeah, but... Who'd want to live in London?
But the point I'm trying to make, though, is I'm surprised. I'm not surprised if big houses are expensive down where you are, because I can imagine rich people moving to sort of fancy places in Dorset. But kind of like, you know, middle level kind of housing, I would have thought was cheaper.
Well, I guess it's all relative, isn't it? Because, yeah. I mean, if you sold your house and moved down here, you could probably live in a mansion. But because I already live here...
I know I can't, Paul, because I've looked.
Oh, have
because
you?
Because if you go to that kind of like higher level, it's all south of England is the same pretty much all the way along.
Right. But I mean, you know, what did you know how much your place is worth? Am I allowed to ask that?
I do, but I'm not going to tell you. Well, I know how much Zoopla tells me it's worth.
Right. Well, I mean, the thing is that my it's all relative, isn't it? It's like if you own a little flat in London, you could buy an enormous place in Dorset. But
yes,
if you already live in Dorset, even if you have a reasonable place, the next up is still a big jump. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, you're right. And I suppose if you are thinking about getting a sort of, you know, nice place kind of thing, then yes, then it suddenly stops mattering where you are.
Yeah.
It's more okay. If it's lovely, beautiful Dorset countryside, then it's going to cost a packet.
Yeah. So
yeah, you're stuffed. So, stay where you are, Paul.
Well, that's what,
spend money on your own house.
That's exactly what we're doing. But we'll never get it back. That's the annoying bit. Is because of the street that we live in that's not the most salubrious of streets.
Are you going for turrets?
Yes.
And another three floors?
Yeah.
So you can then, have a helicopter pad on the top of your fifth floor.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're doing. And the lions will be overlooking the helipad.
You're going for digital house, aren't you? Everything's going to be super, super ticky.
Actually, we're not. It's just open plan. We're just opening out. But I'm going to do nice things to my office, which is good.
Oh, tell me, because I look at my office and go, well, this is nice, but I thought I haven't changed it in 15 years.
Yeah.
What could I do?
Well, I don't know about you, because your office is a converted bedroom, isn't it, basically?
It is, yeah.
So, but in my case, it was a double garage.
It's not as big as yours,
yeah.
But I do have a sofa in it, so it's not like tiny.
So we're going to replace the roof, because it's a flat roof that needs replacing anyway. So we're going to get a vaulted ceiling.
That'll be nice.
Which would be nice. And then
I've already got one of those, though.
At the front of the garage, so to speak, where the door used to be for the front of the garage is going to be a floor-to-ceiling window.
Nice.
And then, if you remember, at the back of my office bit, there's a storeroom, and we're going to convert that into a downstairs toilet and a kind of little kitcheny bit and stuff. So, yes,
okay.
It's all going to be very
cool.
Nice.
And you're going to go and wait. You're going to go and live in Plummer Manor while it's all being done.
Oh, that sounds like a good plan,
doesn't it? That would be fantastic. You could probably get a deal as well.
6 months in the Plummer Manor.
You're not having it out for 6 months, are you?
Yeah, well, this is the trouble. Is
wow.
We're getting a lot done. The whole of the ground floor is being redone. Most of, a big chunk of the upstairs is being fiddled with as well.
Is there one person doing this work?
No, there's a group of people, but it just takes time. But also, to be honest, you can't get a rental for less than 6 months. I don't think they'll be doing it
for six
months, but we have to take 6 months worth of rental.
Understood. Yes, so, that makes sense.
There we go. So that's really exciting for people. I'm sure they're fascinated by that. See, that was good 9 minutes spent. I think that was worthwhile.
I'm actually genuinely interested in people doing their houses up. So I guess other people are.
Well, too. I'm spending, we spend, because I work from home and James is home educated and Kath is teaching James at home. We're in the house the whole time. So, it's worth spending money on, isn't it?
How old is he now?
Oh, 28.
He's not 28.
No, he's 14.
So he's half that, isn't he? And is he taller than you?
Almost.
Yeah, it's going to happen, isn't it?
It's very close now. It's getting very close. So, yeah. So he's... we got him for a few more years. And then hopefully, you know...
Bye.
Yeah.
I think I mentioned that last week, didn't I? That James has graduated now and he's been for interviews for jobs.
Ooh,
it's like a proper grown-up.
I know, right? That's weird.
It's excellent. Yeah. So I don't mind, though. It's good.
Yeah. So if we want to try and vaguely bring it back to what we talk about, I'm hoping to be able to put the renovation of the office part against the business.
Well, that's fair enough.
Oh, yeah, but I've got to get past my accountant first. She's a bit of a stickler. I'll change accountant.
Because you don't have an office, do you? That is your place of work.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I couldn't do that because then it would be like I'd be claiming that my house was a place of work, which it isn't. I just work from home sometimes.
Yeah.
But it's different for you.
Exactly.
So, yes, you should be able to. Definitely.
I'm going to try my damnedest. Anyway, should we talk quickly about a sponsor and then get on to our first talk? Because I think this might be quite a long show because
Are you going to talk literally quickly?
No. I'm going to quickly move on to...
Okay.
Well...
I'll just drink some tea then and listen.
To be honest, by this point, I think that quickly moving on to has long since passed, doesn't it?
Oh, by the way, I'm in the office today and all the guys say, "Hello, Paul."
Oh, so none of the other times that you've been in the office doing it, have they ever acknowledged my existence?
If I'm honest, no.
That's just great. Why today? They obviously want something from me.
It's because I kicked them out of the meeting room saying, "I need to set up."
Oh, I see.
And then it was like, "Oh, say hello to Paul."
Oh, so they've remembered I exist. That's nice.
Yeah, just vaguely.
Okay. So let's talk about Full Story. Because I want to tell you a little story. About Full Story.
Yeah.
Well, actually, do you remember a while ago I was saying about how I'd been looking at Full Story and I'd noticed that people had they seemed to click on the first paragraph of text. Do you remember me saying this?
You have mentioned this,
yeah.
Yes.
So somebody picked up on it in the Slack channel when they heard me say out the podcast and said, "I wonder whether they're selecting it in order to share it," right?
Yes, and I thought, people do that. And just as a slight a tangent on that, we did some testing with some lawyers for site we're doing, and that's what they do. They go into other people's bios, and they basically select all the text, and they copy and paste it to wherever their email or whatever Word document, and they don't want all lots of tabs hiding all the content. They just want it all in one big long list.
Yeah. So they can select it.
Yeah. Tangent made.
No, it's a good tangent. So I thought I'd try an experiment based on, you know, one person do it. Because the way that Full Story works, right, is that you can watch a video back. You see someone do this thing you think is strange. And you go, I wonder whether other people do that. And you can essentially then swap over to what's called a heat map view. All right.
Yep.
So, but it's not that normal kind of splotchy confusion. Do you know what I mean? Where you get all these blobs all over the place and you don't really know what's going on. Instead, it literally just gives you like one to 20 or whatever different dots on the page of what things are clicked on the most. And this was coming out really quite high, so a lot of people were doing it. And you can then click through on any one of those blobs. And actually see how many people are doing it. And you could even go through and search and watch other sessions of people doing the same thing. So it's a really great way of kind of building up a picture of what's going on. And the more of these videos that I watched that were all clicking on the same thing, the more I was thinking, yeah, that's what they're doing. So what I've done, if you go on the site now and you select a piece of text, it does that medium thing where you get a little popover where you can share it on Twitter or Facebook or whatever else. Mm-hmm. And it's caused a real jump in the number of people sharing my content online. And it's like...
Good.
Yes. So, like, it really works. And Full Story, you know, being able to go through and actually drill down and go... Well, first of all, it's that thing of... oh, it's made me spot something, and you think, oh, that's a bit peculiar. Then you kind of form a hypothesis about why that might be, and you drill down and you can look at other people and whether they seem to be doing the same thing. Then you can go away and update something and come back and see whether or not it's made a difference. And it's really good, really good. So anyway, you can sign up and try it for yourself and see whether you get similar kind of results and you learn as much. You get a free month of their pro account for free, which means that all of your sessions will be recorded. You don't have to sign up with a credit card or anything else like that. And then at the end of that month, you can either start paying or you can continue for free and it will record 1,000 sessions per month. All right, so totally no reason why not to give it a go, really. You can try it out by going to fullstory.com/BOAG, B-O-A-G. So there you go. That is Full Story and my little story about Full Story.
Aww.
Right, so next up we've got Kenneth Bowles, who is he's a guy we've known for years, isn't he? So
yep, absolutely.
Kenneth is a designer and writer, focuses he's focusing at the moment a lot on the ethics of emerging technologies, which is something that I'm really interested in. So he's worked with all kinds of companies, including Twitter, Samsung, WWF. He's also author of one of my favorite books, which is Undercover User Experience Design, and is currently working on his second book, which is about persuasive technologies and that kind of thing, I believe. If you want to know more about him, you can now I'm going to spell it, because although he's called Kenneth, it's not spelt the way you think it is. I think it's spelt Welsh, isn't it?
It's the Welsh spelling.
It's the Welsh spelling. So if you want to check out more about him, you can do so by going to CENNYDD.com. That is such a Welsh word, isn't it?
Yep.
You could just look at
many
it.
Many D's.
Many D's. A random L's Y. Usually. And yes, it's all just, yeah. So anyway, yes, check it out. This is his talk. So his talk is on what is called persuasive elitism, which is how we are people that, as technologists, that we have a huge influence on people's behavior these days. And is it right that we get to do that? And where is the line in all of that? But I'll let Kenneth explain himself.
All technologies have the power to persuade. Nothing so full of language and light and energy could ever be inert. But lately, persuasion has become an explicit goal of technology. Nudge theory, the idea that you can change someone's behaviour through good design or good choice architecture alone, that's become prominent in the public sector. And it's here that we see ideas such as changing defaults to increase organ donation or to encourage people to put more savings into their pension pots. But increasingly, we're seeing this idea of behaviour design being adopted by Silicon Valley as well, largely thanks to the pioneering work from people like BJ Fogg or his student Nir Eyal, who wrote a book called Hooked. If I were to take a quick scroll through the apps on my phone, Strava, Withings, CityMapper, and of course Twitter and Facebook, they all use persuasive techniques. Now, if we were rational humans, the idea of digital persuasion would be easy. You just present the costs and the benefits of various options, and you have faith that the user will choose the optimal outcome. But of course, we all know that we aren't rational actors. So persuasive approaches, we have to try a different tack. We have to essentially exploit cognitive bias and emotion. Now, persuasion mostly has a cozy and positive image, so we tend not to mind that. Who doesn't want to be more active, after all? Who doesn't want to be more financially responsible or to explore their city more? These techniques, yes, they exploit human weakness, but they do it so that we can overcome human weakness. But my concern is these same techniques, of course, have murkier applications. You can use persuasive techniques to encourage gambling as easily as you can to encourage financial prudence. The dark pattern is now essentially de rigueur across the web, an interface designed to deceive users into acting into company interests and not their own. And tech, on its current trajectory of becoming yet more unfamiliar to users and yet more obfuscated, mostly because of designers and their sensible notion to try and conceal some of the complexity of what's happening in these systems. That black box design means there's significant scope to screw people over. Now, of course, the dark pattern is, by definition, an unethical piece of design. The more important question is, how do we decide what type of persuasive technologies are ethical? Where do we draw that line? There are a few ethical theories that we can apply to this, but it really just boils down to what's in the user's best interest. And this is where I have perhaps the largest problem, because that appraisal, it's almost always left to technologists. It's left to us to decide what we think should be in the user's best interest. And this doesn't feel right. The best way, surely, to answer that question is to involve the user heavily in our work, is to conduct this deep ethnographic research to really understand people's motivations and their goals and the contexts in which they're going to be using our products. Or better still, maybe we need to adopt a co-design mindset, bringing our users into the design studio or the company environment so that we can actually work alongside them, they can input into the product development process. But that's not really how it's done these days. Instead, we have a mindset that's very much based on the idea of ship it and see experimentation. It's grounded in the mindset of the lean startup. And I think that's very dangerous if you're trying to change people's behaviours. It treats people as means to achieve our own goals rather than treating them as ends in themselves. It doesn't respect the agency and autonomy of the individual users. Now, even if you aren't working on a project where you're intentionally trying to persuade people to change their behaviour, I'd argue you probably are anyway, because any time you set a target in your company or for your product, then that's no longer a true measure of what's happening. Every target gets gamed. And to do that, you need to persuade people to act in certain ways. So any KPI-driven design, any data-driven design, is an exercise in behaviour design. It's the same thing. So tech companies, I think, are all trying to change behaviour. But generally, they're trying to do this in a context of almost no oversight, no upfront anticipation of what the second-order consequences might be, and very little by way of moral reasoning. Essentially, they're happy to just move the needle of behaviour and worry about whether that was the right thing to do a little bit later on. Now, we technologists, designers, engineers, product managers, we've been given a significant amount of power over the shape of the future. Facebook now is the largest nation on Earth. Bitcoin uses globally as much energy as Paraguay. Technologies are becoming more complex, more obscured, but more interwoven into people's lives. I think there's a growing risk with that, that technocracy becomes the guiding system of the world. The fate of humanity is left, at least in part, to those who can define its technologies. So the idea that we should be the arbiters of what's in people's best interest, that really worries me. One of the clearest social movements we've seen over the last 1 or 2 years is a populist revolt against elites. Elites being people who have power over other people's lives, people who get to shape the future the way they want it to be, and who can get everyone else to conform to that vision. Now, unless we can actually involve the public better in decisions of what this technologized future should look like, and unless we particularly gain their input and consent for technology to shape behaviour, I think those accusations absolutely apply to us. We are the technocrats, we are the elites, and I think we need to be damn careful.
So yes, what a brilliant talk. This is such a big thing for me, Marcus, because I've been, I don't know whether you know, but I do a day's workshop on persuasive design.
You do?
Yeah.
Basically, yes. Conning people.
Yeah. we do a whole section on ethics, you know, how far you should go and what you should do and what you shouldn't do. So it's a really interesting area that I don't... It's interesting, isn't it, as to where you draw the line. Sorry, I'm going to just take a drink.
Okay. Yes, and this is quite... There's parallels to what Mike Montero was saying about the designer's responsibility to fight fascism. Mm. But I found that kind of a more... It was more... I didn't have as many arguments against it. My main... I'm not saying Kenneth's wrong, because I don't think he is. I think that we do need to think very carefully about the ethics of the decisions we're making. But some of the examples he was using are basically just what companies do. Companies want to sell things, and they will try and persuade you to buy their thing by the use of advertising.
Yeah, I think that the... Yes, and I accept that, and I understand that. But there is... there is a line there. There are ways and means. You can be very manipulative into...
I agree. So I'm struggling a little bit to play devil's advocate, but it's kind of, if you take it to the nth degree, then you're basically saying that companies just should just sit and wait for people to knock on their door.
Yeah.
Effective, you know. Yes, we've got these things you might be interested in. Whereas, you know... Any kind of advertising campaign you could argue is manipulating people.
Yes, absolutely. But I think maybe, I mean, he wasn't speaking for long, so he wasn't able to get into some of the details of it. There are several issues here. Even if you set aside the morality of it, the truth is that if you manipulate people, then you ultimately create buyer's remorse, right? And in the world that we live in today, I think buyer's remorse can be quite a damaging thing, because essentially what happens is, if people feel like they've been manipulated, even if they haven't, even if you don't think you've manipulated them, if they feel like that, then it can cause a massive backlash. I mean, recently, Uber have got themselves into all kinds of trouble for many, many reasons. But one of those reasons is the pressure they put on drivers to keep driving. And that the driver's app, the app that the drivers are using, is a very manipulative app in order to encourage them to keep going. It's gamified the whole situation. Mm. And there is a balance here, absolutely. People are responsible for their own behaviour, you know, and it's up to the driver whether or not they keep going. But when you put undue pressure on people, you're going to end up upsetting them.
As I said, I'm finding it hard to play devil's advocate on this. Even little old me has written about this. I wrote a piece called Super Shiny Customer Service or You're Dead or something like that, and which basically covers exactly that. If you manipulate people, you're going to lose them forever.
Yeah.
I just think I was just kind of just thinking, how can I push back on this? And that was the one. It's like, if you take it to the nth degree, you could end up basically saying that all advertising is manipulative, therefore it shouldn't be there. He also said one other thing that I thought was impractical is, like, the designers should sit alongside... customers, users should sit alongside designers all the time. And I thought, well, that's not practical. Certainly not practical at the level we work anyway.
Well, I didn't necessarily... I didn't interpret it quite like that. But yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, I love the idea of users and designers working together on a design, but it can't happen all the time. Yeah, you're right. But I mean, for me, I've put a lot of thought into this. It's an excellent book called Nudge that talks about this, and he actually referenced several of the things that is in that book, you know, the idea of using defaults to encourage organ donations and that kind of thing. And it's a really good book for me. That's kind of helped me establish the line for myself, and I think everybody's got to do it individually. I'm happy to persuade somebody to do something that at some level they really want to do, right? So I wouldn't persuade somebody to... I think it's a waste of time, setting aside the morality. I think it's a waste of time trying to persuade somebody to buy a phone if they don't want to buy a phone, right? But if they want a phone, I'm quite happy to persuade them to buy it with me rather than a competitor, and to buy it now rather than put it off. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally.
You know, and that's that. I think that's down to he. You know, one of the things that he mentioned is actually sometimes good design, what you perceive as maybe being slightly manipulative design, is actually design that's just counterbalancing some other psychological trait. So, for example, one trait that we have is that the fact that we've got this lizard brain, this old part of our brain that you know, is all about survival and that kind of thing. And that part of the brain gets very upset when it has to do things like part with money, because it wants to hoard, and, you know, so that it's got like a cache to protect itself. So, you know, I'm quite happy to counteract that natural, you know, kind of disposition that stops us doing stuff. But it's where you then kind of take that further and start to really play off of people's emotions and that kind of thing. It's interesting because it's been around for years, isn't it?
And I think I'd like to, well, if he's writing a book about it, I'll just buy the book and have a read. Because it was just, like you say, I'm just sort of left going, yeah, I need to know more.
Yeah.
About what you're thinking.
The other thing he said, which I thought, he talked about KPIs and setting KPIs. And I think that's a very interesting one because, he was saying it from the point of view that, you know, if organizations have KPIs, then that can put pressure on employees to, you know, to be ever more manipulative in order to reach those KPIs.
Absolutely.
But the other kind of thing where you have to be a little bit careful about those kinds of things, those targets that you're asking people to meet, is that sometimes it can skew your priorities. You know, I always remember, I won't say the name of the company, but they sold project management software.
I do. Yes, I do remember them. Yes.
And they had this peculiar thing, didn't they, where their marketing department and their sales department sat separately. Mm-hmm. And the sales department was measured on how many leads it converted, and the marketing department was measured on how many leads it generated. So the marketing department had this wonderful idea. Well, let's make the website so that nobody can view our product until they hand across an email address, right?
Yeah.
Which enabled them to meet their targets and their KPIs. But the result is the sales department had a whole load of email addresses of people that didn't really give a shit about their product or want it at that particular moment. So, you know.
Yeah, but that's the blog post I mentioned, it was inspired by an experience I had with AO.com, who sell white goods.
Yeah.
I bought a washing machine, I think, back in January this year, maybe even before then. And the website is just superb. The copy, everything, the steps through to buying it. And, the guys who deliver it are fantastic. So I didn't even look anywhere else. Cause everything breaks at the same time, doesn't it?
Yeah.
We needed a new dishwasher, and that was it. Boom. My experience with AO was so good, I'm going back there.
Mm.
And again, once again, in every way, it was fantastic, except for, and I don't remember this happening on the first call, so maybe it was a new process that they'd added to the added to their sales processes. Where I got a call from a guy saying, just wanted to check you, we'd got the right details of your order.
Right.
And it wasn't that at all. It was, I'm going to try and sell you some insurance.
Oh.
And not only was it kind of disguised as something else, it was really, really hard sell. He would basically tell a little story about what this thing that he was selling, and then sort of like finish off by saying, "So that's great. So you're in for that," and move on to the next thing. It took me saying, "Hang on a sec, I'm not interested. I don't want it." At which point he would say, "Oh, well, if you're sure," and all this kind of thing. And it's just like, it was just such a bad experience in amongst all this other brilliant experience that it made me think, I've got to write about this. And with the point being, one part of your, you know, your sales process can completely ruin it for others. I also made the point that this guy will be being measured on how much he sells.
Yeah.
End of. and how much it damages the process going forward will not be being considered.
Yeah.
And that's why you need a kind of experienced director or a very senior person who can look at the whole experience holistically, because you end up with that kind of thing. I'll never go back there again.
Yeah.
They have lost me forever. So, yeah.
There you go. I think that sums it up perfectly, doesn't it? I mean, ultimately, manipulating people, I think, comes back and bites you. You know, yes. It's saying, you know, Kenneth's talk was great, and I totally agree with what he was saying. But he was still looking at it from an ethical and moral point of view. But I think even if you take that out of it, I think it's bad business. You know, unless you're somebody that is going for a quick win and then you're going to close shop and bog off, and, you know, then fair enough from a non-ethical point of view. But from any other, if you're trying to run any kind of long-term business, manipulating people too much, if you overstep that line, or even if your users perceive that you've overstepped it, then you've got serious problems in terms of repeat business, in terms of winning new customers, because, you know, your negative reputation gets out there, just like you've just said what you've said, you know. Yeah. Okay.
Moving on.
Let's talk about our second sponsor for the day. Our second sponsor is a new one. We've got FreshBooks. Well, I say new one. I think it was season 14 or something that they sponsored us on, and they're back, which is lovely.
Splendid.
If you don't know who FreshBooks are, they're basically a super intuitive, easy to use tool for creating and sending invoices and all that kind of gubbins. So, you know, using FreshBooks, it's only going to take you about 30 seconds to throw together and send out an invoice. You can obviously add your own logo and color scheme and all of that kind of stuff and branding. And your clients can even pay online, which can seriously improve how quickly you get paid. I encourage all of my clients to do that. FreshBooks can show you whether or not your client has looked at the invoice, or even looked at the email that's been sent out, so which is obviously very useful, because then they don't have any excuse when they go, oh, I didn't get your invoice. It can also send out late payment reminders to the client automatically, which means that you're not spending all your time chasing those clients down for late payments and that kind of thing, which is very useful again. You can also use FreshBooks deposit feature, which streamlines how you invoice money up front when you kick off a project. So if you're going to get a deposit for it, then it can help you deal with all that kind of thing. But the most important thing really to know about FreshBooks, from what I've seen of it, is it's extremely simple. Even if you're not a numbers person, you know, like me. In fact, especially if you're not a numbers person, it's designed for me. It offers a monthly unrestricted FreshBooks are offering a month of unrestricted use to everybody who's listening to the show, which is totally free. You can claim it right now. You don't need to enter a credit card again, which is great. So to claim your free month of unrestricted access to it, go to freshbooks.com/boagworld. Now, when you sign up, you'll need to enter Boag World UX Show into How Did You Hear About Us? So make sure you do that. Otherwise, you won't get your unrestricted access, so I am told. Okay, so that's FreshBooks. Check them out. And thank you very much, Mr. FreshBooks, for sponsoring us on the show. Because it is named after Mr. FreshBooks.
Is it?
No,
really?
No, of course it's not. you actually believed me for a moment there, didn't you?
Jimmy FreshBooks.
Jimmy FreshBooks. That would be an awesome name. I'm going to change my name via Depol to that now. Okay, so next up, we've got Lee Batchelor, who you can find out more about him at leebatchelor.co.uk. He started off with a design background, and he seems to have progressively moved over the years more and more into the web development side of things. So for the past 7 years, he's been working as a developer in-house for some of the UK's biggest charities. while still doing various side projects along the way as well. And he's going to talk about that, really. Not the side projects bit, but the working in-house as an in-house developer. And there are so many different ways, aren't there, of managing development within your organization in terms of whether you do it in-house or whether you use a freelancer or go to an agency or anything, any of the rest. So Lee's going to share with you his thoughts on the subject. As an in-house developer, you'll never guess what he's going to recommend. So over to Lee.
Working as an in-house web developer can offer a different perspective from being in an agency. For a developer, there can be challenges and opportunities in equal measure. And I think an in-house digital team can be a great environment to work in. From the organization's point of view, an in-house developer can be a real asset that'll allow the team to be more flexible in the way they work. Every web is different, so the way a developer will fit into your organisation will vary depending on the size and type of the team and how it fits in with the rest of the company. I wanted to share some of my experiences of working in-house in a few different places, more often than not as the only web developer on the team. First up, it's probably worth saying something about what I mean when I say developer. One thing about working in-house is that regardless of what your official job title is, you'll most likely be wearing a few different hats. Whatever it might say in your job description, there's a good chance that some people will just get to think of you as the web guy or girl, and you'll end up doing a lot more besides writing code. Let's take developer in this instance to mean someone who's working on the technical side of an organization's digital channels. With a huge range of possible external resources available, from low-cost, remote working freelancers to established agencies with a proven track record, why would an organisation want to invest in adding an in-house developer to their team? I think using any one of those resources doesn't necessarily prevent an organisation from using the others if the situation calls for it. In fact, a combination of all three can allow an organisation to flex over time with the changing workload. Although the associated costs of employing somebody on payroll are going to outweigh using freelancers, there are plenty of other benefits which make it worthwhile investing in the extra internal resource. One of the real benefits of having somebody in-house is that they're going to be focused entirely on your company's work. You won't have to compete with other clients for their time, and you can more easily respond to changing priorities. One thing about being in-house is that development is probably not going to be the main focus of the organization's work. Someone has seen the benefit of recruiting an in-house developer, but you might need to put in a bit of work with other teams to get them to understand the role. If you're lucky, it might be an existing role and there have been predecessors who have fought some of these battles for you already. As a developer joining an in-house team, one of the first hurdles you might have to get over is getting a machine you can actually get your work done on. Unfortunately, you might not have the latest shiny new MacBook to work with. To start out with, at least, I've always been given a bog-standard Windows laptop exactly the same as somebody in finance gets to do their spreadsheets on. If I was really lucky, I might get a bit of extra memory thrown in, but that's probably about the best I could hope for. One of your first tasks will be making friends with the IT department. Getting them to understand why your requirements are a bit different from their typical office computer can take a bit of time, but is definitely worth it. There's a lot that could be said about where Windows falls short as a platform for development, but if you're in a company that's working on a Windows environment, you might just have to suck it up and live with it. You can definitely make working with Windows a lot less painful though. If you don't have admin rights to your machine, it can get tedious pretty quickly if you're constantly coming up against Windows user access control every time you want to do something. Luckily, it will be just as tedious for the IT help desk if every time that happens, you're onto them to let you do what you need to. They'll probably tire of it pretty quickly, and they might begin to take a different view about whether or not you need admin rights to your machine. I've been in the situation before where I've finally got a development environment up and running, having jumped through all of Windows hoops to get there, only to come in the following week to find that IT have made a remote change to all the organization's computers, which had completely destroyed the virtual machine. If you're able to have the conversations early on about what you need and why you need it, it's easier for your colleagues to understand the implications of any potential system changes. When you don't have complete control over the tools you're working with, backing up early and often is especially important to avoid the risk of unpleasant surprises. The closer working relationships you can build with colleagues as an in-house developer mean that when problems do come up, you're much better placed to deal with them. On the plus side, with all those challenges, being the only developer in a company has meant that my system admin skills have come on light years. Coming from a design background, the command line used to seem a scary and intimidating place. But after regularly fighting to get a development environment working reliably on a half-locked-down Windows laptop, it's become a second home. And that's one of the great things about working in-house, especially as part of a small team. Your role can be really varied and full of different directions you can stretch yourself in. There are plenty of areas that you can learn about and improve in if you're interested. You could code like the last 20 years haven't happened, nesting tables within tables within tables to create some really beautiful HTML emails. You can get into number crunching, analytics and A/B testing. And somebody somewhere will inevitably insist that you should be developing an app for some reason or other. So if that's not a completely harebrained idea, you could even think about doing that. All the while, you're likely to be juggling so many competing demands on your time that your project management is going to be up there with the best, and it will need to be. The only potential problem with all of this possibility is that if there's only one of you, you might end up being spread pretty thinly. Inevitably, there will be times when you just can't do it all, and you will need to rely on external support to get some things done. It will tend to be the bigger projects that go out to agencies. Sometimes because it will take you a lifetime to do them in-house alongside all of the other demands on your time. And sometimes because the opinions of an external agency can carry a bit more weight in some organisations than those of an internal team, which can be a bit frustrating. Hopefully, your organisation's procurement process will allow you to get involved in the selection of whatever agency you'll be working with. And it really should, because this is one area where having somebody in-house who can come at a project from a technical perspective is invaluable. So often, problems arise during the course of a project because of scope creep or the knock-on implications of changes not being fully considered. Having someone on your team who is able to take the business needs of the organisation and translate them into a detailed brief for an agency means that the budget you're spending on external resources is focused on getting the job done rather than figuring out what it is you're asking for. It makes for a much more productive relationship, and you're more likely to get what you want on time and on budget. When you're choosing an agency to work with, it can be really useful to have clear development standards defined that they'll have to sign up to. That way you can be confident that whoever is working on the site, somebody else will be able to pick up the code further down the line and support it. For an in-house developer in a small team, there's a risk that you start seeing a lot of interesting, larger scale projects going out to agencies, simply because you don't have the capacity to deliver them as quickly in-house. You run the risk of beginning to feel that you're missing out on the good stuff. While some agencies have an approach to collaboration, like throwing a hand grenade over the wall and running away, I've been lucky enough to work with some really great agencies who value close collaboration. Those projects where the in-house team and agency are able to work closely together are always the most successful and with the least friction points. If you're the only developer in your team, having that opportunity to work closely with other developers every now and then can be a welcome reminder that there are other people out there who share some of the same frustrations and problems that you might usually have to deal with on your own. That's why looking for ways to get involved in the wider development community can be really useful too. There'll be conferences, workshops or meetups you can go to, as well as all sorts of online spaces where you can connect with other developers. Being actively involved in any development being carried out by agencies puts an in-house developer in a much better position when it comes to ongoing support of the site. For the organisation, having that technical knowledge in-house means that you're much more self-sufficient and better placed to extend the functionality further down the line if you need to. If you're in-house, you're going to get really good at managing and supporting your organisation's sites and systems, but you might feel as if you're missing out on the variety of work that someone in an agency has. The rate of change in our industry can sometimes feel overwhelming, and if you're working on the same site or sites all the time, it can be especially easy to feel as if you're struggling to keep up with the latest developments. There might be opportunities in your everyday work to inject a bit of variety and mix things up a little, but you can always use side projects to expand your experience in directions that you can't fit into the 9-to-5. As long as it's not interfering with your full-time job, I've always worked in organisations that are happy for me to have side projects on the go. And I think that's a really important factor in your own development. Ultimately, the organisation benefits from the learnings that come out of those projects, and having something a bit more varied to work on can reduce the risk of you getting disengaged during those times when the day job can feel a bit of a drag. Like all of these things, though, it's important to make sure you get a reasonable amount of life in the work-life balance to reduce the risk of getting overloaded. And it's not just on the technical front that having a developer in-house is an asset. They'll have the chance to really get to know the organisation in a way that you just can't from the outside. That perspective and the relationships that you can build will allow you to be a lot more proactive. An in-house developer is better placed to anticipate the needs of an organisation and find the solution to problems much quicker than having to go backwards and forwards with external suppliers. If you're lucky enough to have a reasonable sized digital team with some UX expertise and content creators on board, you can make your in-house unit a real force to drive digital innovation in your organisation. If you get the right person in the right in-house role and give them the tools they need to get on with doing their job, you can really unlock the potential of a digital team and the organisation. As a developer, being part of an in-house team can give you an opportunity to really get under the skin of an organisation and have a lasting long-term impact. It'll also allow you to try new things and stretch yourself in all sorts of different directions you probably can't anticipate. There's no one-size-fits-all approach that will work for everyone or for every organisation, but I'd really recommend considering adding a developer to your in-house team, and if you're a developer, considering taking on an in-house role and seeing if it works for you.
So I have to say, I do agree with Lee. I do think that most organisations should be looking at building up some in-house skill these days. Even as somebody who's still a non-executive director of an agency, I still think that.
I haven't really got anything to say on this one.
Have you not?
Well, you know, in-house developer? Well, no, just use agencies.
Really?
That's what I think.
You don't believe that?
No, I don't, and neither does Lee. Lee thinks it should be a mixture, as do I.
Yeah, that's...
So,
yeah.
There you go.
Because, I mean, are there any of Headscape's clients that don't have some kind of in-house digital capability?
It depends. There are a few that don't have developers, but all of them have web teams. But, yeah, there are quite a few that don't have, you know, people that can code specifically.
Yeah.
Still.
Yeah, that's... Yeah, and I suppose that's true.
I mean, I would argue that number one is content people. That's what you need first.
You need
a leader first, but after that it's content people, and then you need to start getting into the more kind of technical roles. But yeah, generally speaking, I agree with them entirely. I suppose it depends on the size of the organisation. Universities, as we talked about, and got quite an interesting reaction on Twitter, I noticed.
Did we? What did we say about...
We said how refreshing it was to see how far ahead the university sector web teams, digital teams are compared to maybe some others, which was met with open mouths by a few on Twitter.
Yeah, and we're all doomed if that's the state of in-house teams.
Well, I did like the analogy, because you basically responded by saying, well, that's our experience. It certainly seems to have improved a lot over... And I think the analogy was, oh, well, maybe there's this... I don't know. It was like a kind of a shining light pulling along a burning barge or something like that.
Yeah, that was it.
Made me laugh.
Which is probably about right, actually, I think, when it comes to the HE sector. But anyway, that's off topic.
I've gone off tangent hugely. I can't even remember what point I was making or what I was referring to. But along the lines of, yeah, I completely agree with Lee from the other side. We can't survive, certainly Headscape, we're too small to offer a kind of regular position in any organisation. So yeah, of course, a kind of balance between the two makes the most sense to me.
There are some interesting challenges, mine. I mean, if I was forced to come up with a one size fits all solution, which is obviously never the right approach, but I'm leaning toward... See, there are certain problems, as Lee pointed out, of working in-house, okay? That, in my experience, in-house developers are not particularly well looked after, right? Because management don't really understand what they do, because they're kind of forced to use the same kit as everybody else, they never get the training that they need. You know, especially if they're a lone developer, they're isolated, so it's hard to learn and keep up.
Sounds awful. Join an agency.
Well, There are challenges, because I think that, you know, if you're say a charity like Lee works with, you know, they don't know how to run an in-house digital team because they're not digital experts. Correct. So one model that I'm leaning towards at the moment is a kind of outsource your in-house team. Well, I've talked to you about this, haven't I?
You and
Chris, which is this idea that, okay, as an in-house, I tell you where I got the idea from is catering, which is a bit bizarre. So a lot of universities, you know, they always used to have their own kind of kitchen staff and, you know, all of this kind of stuff. And then they kind of came to this realization that, well, actually, we don't want, you know, we're about learning. You know, why are we running kitchen staff? So what they do is they commission a third party to essentially run the in-house catering services for the organization. And those people work within the organization, but they're employed by a third party third party company. And I actually think that model works quite well for digital as well, because it avoids a lot of the problems. So for example, you know, if a developer was working for someone like you and Chris, for example, so say if you hired Lee, right? Lee then carries on working in the charity that he's working in, but he actually is employed by you. That means now you're the person supplying him with the kit, right? So he gets the shiny new Mac. He's also in contact with the other developers that you've hired. Even though he's the only developer working in that charity, he's still in contact with other people at Headscape.
Yeah.
You know, so that means he's learning that kind of stuff. You recognize, because you are experienced digital people, that he needs training. So you've kind of factored that into the cost of everything. So he goes and gets the training he needs. You know, you're the one that's doing his appraisal every year, so you actually understand whether or not he's doing his job well. And he's kind of protected from the organizational differences between the client and, you know, and how we work as digital people. Does that make sense?
It does.
And then the charity doesn't have to have any of the hassle of, you know, dealing with kind of a different group of people that's not their area of expertise or their responsibility, but they still get all of the benefits of having someone in-house.
Yeah. Interesting.
It's my current view on the subject. I'll probably change my mind in a few weeks, but that's what I'm currently.
It kind of comes down to, should it just be designers and developers, or should agencies like Headscape be offering sort of whole teams of content people as well? I don't know. It suddenly becomes complicated in my head. But then I think Headscape are probably a bad example, because we're not looking to expand, so we're quite happy as we are.
Yeah, that's...
But I guess if we were looking to expand, then that would be a way we could do it. So offering teams to people. Yeah,
interesting. My problem without not having an in-house team, right, and just using an agency, is that when you're constantly paying an outside supplier, like, say, Headscape again, and you don't have anybody in-house to do that kind of stuff, I think organisations become reluctant to spend money, understandably so, because of the costs associated with it. And so that makes them reluctant to incrementally improve their website.
Yeah.
Which is a problem, isn't it? And actually, when you've got someone in-house and you're paying their regular salary, it actually encourages the complete opposite of that, because you want to get your money's worth out of the person. So that's why that kind of halfway house of what I said, you know, what I described a minute ago, works, because you're still paying for that ongoing person, even though they're being managed outside.
I guess, one major issue would be getting some kind of parity between what an agency could charge versus what a charity, say, could pick up a developer for from a salary point of view, because I suspect there's quite a disparity there.
Well, yeah, there would be, because there'd be a markup difference in terms of, you would have an administrative overhead of managing that developer and doing his appraisals and all of that kind of stuff. Then you'd need to provide kit for them. Then you'd need to provide training for them. But the truth is, the organization is doing that anyway. The charity would have to do that if you weren't doing it. The trouble is, it's a hidden cost and they're not seeing that they're having to do that. So the two, you know, so doing it via you would seem like a big markup, even though it probably isn't in reality. So it's an interesting idea. And I know some agencies that made it work, but it's, you know, it's not without its problems. And like you say, I don't think it's necessarily right for Headscape because you guys, you know, want an easy life.
Basically, what's wrong with that?
Nothing. Oh, nothing. I'm not in any way criticizing. You know, the day one we set up Headscape, we said we wanted a lifestyle business, didn't we? And, you know.
Yep.
So that comes at the top of the list, in my opinion. Okay. I think we're about done, aren't we?
I think we are.
So I wanted to let people know that I think we filled all our slots.
Lee has told me he'll get it done by the end of the week.
I'll squeeze Lee in. Actually, I can squeeze some more in, I've just thought, because I can move up to three per show if I need to. So feel free to send more if you want to. But at least now we've got enough content to finish the season.
Hooray!
Hooray! Woo! That's encouraging, as we're on episode 11. Right, Marcus, joke.
This is from Kieran McGrath in the Bad Joke Slack channel. I like it very much. I got my friend an elephant for his room. He said, thanks. I said, don't mention it.
Elephant in a room. Oh, I see. I get it.
I thought it was rather good.
That's good.
Yeah, all right. Okay, fell a bit flat. When I read it, I thought it was really funny.
Sometimes some things work better written.
Yeah, they do. That's obviously one of them.
Or some things work better when you're not telling them.
Yeah, that's true. I can't deny that.
Okay, so that's this week's show. Thank you very much for listening. We shall return again next week with more Lightning Talks. But until then, thanks for listening. Bye. Bye.